Overrun. Too many things were happening at the same time, all of them bad. Durant's crash site was in imminent danger of being overrun. Most of the original assaulters, about 160 D-boys and Rangers, were now either cut to pieces on the limping ground convoy or strung out on foot between the target house and the first helicopter crash site. Forces from a full company of the 10th Mountain Division, another 150 men, had arrived at the task force's base and thrown itself into the effort to reach Durant's crash site, but they were running into the same problems as the other vehicles trying to move through the deadly ambushes and roadblocks that had been erected all over the city. Two more 10th Mountain companies were en route, and the UN's Pakistani and Malaysian forces had agreed to add their tanks and armored personnel carriers to the fight. But the logistics of assembling this polyglot rescue convoy would be daunting and would take hours. In two more hours, it would be dark. The men fighting for their lives out in the city knew nothing of the bigger picture. They could not see beyond the increasingly desperate struggle on their corner, and each still fought with the expectation that rescue was just minutes away. Shortly before Durant's helicopter had been shot down, the one and only airborne rescue team had roped into the first crash site. Air Force Technical Sergeant Tim Wilkinson was one of the two Air Force parajumpers on board. Wilkinson and the other Air Force guys practiced emergency medicine like an extreme sport. Their unit's motto, anytime, anywhere, was a point of pride. They were trained to climb cliffs, search deserts, and to dive out of airplanes at extremely high altitudes, if necessary, sometimes far behind enemy lines, to track lost and wounded flyers, patch them up, and bring them home. Also on board the Combat Search and Rescue Black Hawk was a five-man team of D-boys and seven Rangers. They moved over Walcott's downed Black Hawk exactly 8 minutes after it crashed. Pilot Dan Gelada flew in and hovered about 30 feet over the street. From his middle spot in the bird, Wilkinson couldn't see anything. He was taking his cues from Master Sergeant Scott Fales, his team leader. They made eye contact and nodded. This is it. Then Gelada said it was time. The ropes were kicked out, and men started sliding down. When it was his turn, Wilkinson noticed that the essential kit bags, which were supposed to be kicked out first, had been left behind. So he and Fales waited until the men before them had cleared the rope and then kicked out the bags. They made one last check around inside the now empty bird before they jumped. The delay was costly. As Gelada held his hover these few extra seconds, an RPG exploded on the left side of his airframe. Gelada could hear his rotor blades whistling. Shrapnel from the blast had peppered them with holes. Once Wilkinson and Fales were on the ground, Super 6-8 limped low and slow across the city, trailing a thin gray plume. Gelada struggled in the cockpit to fly it. It was like maneuvering a truck on a sheet of ice. The sturdy Black Hawk kept going. They flew past the open field and then slipped over the fencing to the airport base. They landed with a jolt, but the Black Hawk stayed upright and intact. As soon as Wilkinson hit the street, he heard the snap of rounds passing nearby. They had been put down on Marahan Road, a wide dirt road immediately east of the crash. He saw some of his team across the road moving up a narrow alley. As he rounded the corner to the alley, he saw the wreck. It looked tragic, like a harpooned whale beached on its left side. Much had already happened. The rescue team's D-boys and Rangers, including the group from Chalk 2, who had run over from the target building, had set up a small perimeter, basically guarding the alley to the front and rear of the downed aircraft. There were a few dead Somalis scattered on the street. People would rush out, often women or children, to retrieve their weapons, and others would step out to pull bodies to cover. Sergeant Fales was at the front end of the wreckage, stretching up to peer inside when he felt a tug at his left pants leg. Then came the pain. It felt like a hot poker had been stabbed through his calf muscle. Here he was, after years of training for a moment like this, and after less than 3 minutes on the ground, he'd been shot. How was he to direct his rescue with a big, bloody hole in his leg? Wilkinson caught up as Fales hobbled back toward the tail of the bird. Delta Sergeant First Class Bob Mabry had him under one arm. Fales and Mabry ducked into the hole the crashing helicopter had knocked in the south wall of the alley. The injury to his partner heightened Wilkinson's sense of urgency. He moved up to the front. A Delta sniper, Sergeant First Class James McMahon, who had been on Super 6-1 when it crashed, was already on top of the bird pulling out Bull Briley. McMahon's face was badly cut and swollen and had already turned black and blue. He looked like he was wearing a fright mask. Briley was obviously dead. Wilkinson helped McMahon pull Briley up and out, and then handed his body down. McMahon climbed down into the cockpit and checked on Elvis. "He's dead," he told Wilkinson. Wilkinson felt the need to see for himself. It was eerily quiet inside the bird. There had been no fire and there was no smoke. Reaching down, he checked Walcott's neck for a pulse. He was dead. Both pilots had taken the brunt of the impact. Walcott's head and upper torso were intact, but the rest of him was wedged tightly under the instrument panel. There was going to be no easy way to get him out. Shortly before the other Rangers came down ropes to the crashed helicopter, Abdiaziz Ali Aden had darted out from under the green Volkswagen. The slender Somali teenager with the head of thick, bushy hair had seen the helicopter clip the roof of his house before falling into the alley. He had helped his family to safety and then returned to protect the house from looters, only to find himself in the middle of a gunfight. He saw one of the Americans who roped down pick up an M16 from a man he had just shot. As the soldier came toward him, Aden panicked. He slid out from under the car and ran back into his house, slamming the door shut. He ran to a small storage room that had two windows, one that faced out over the alleyway where the helicopter lay, the other that looked out on Marahan Road, where more Rangers were descending. The intersection and alley then swarmed with American soldiers, and the shooting was loud, constant, and accelerating. The walls of his house were built of heavy stone, so he had a safe ringside seat. Across the city, about a mile southwest, Black Hawk pilots Mike Gaffina and Jim Yacone circled over Durant's wrecked bird, worriedly. They could already see Somalis spilling into alleyways and footpaths, homing in on the downed helicopter. Before the Quick Reaction Force Company had arrived, Garrison ordered up an emergency convoy at the base. Leading it out would be the Rangers and D-Boys who had evacuated Private Blackburn, and joining them would be dozens of support personnel, armorers, cooks, ammo handlers, and communications specialists, including an Air Force air traffic controller, who volunteered to join the fight. At the base, Dale Sizemore had been going nuts listening to the radio. These were his brothers, his Ranger buddies out there pinned down, and they were getting hammered. He heard screams of pain and fear in the voices of hardened men. This was the big fight they'd all been preparing for all these years, and here he was pacing around the radio with a fucking cast on his arm. Some days earlier, Sizemore had banged his elbow, goofing off in the hangar. He woke up on his cot under the bug net early Friday morning, 2 days before the raid, to find his elbow so swollen and painful he couldn't sleep. He was flown up to the hospital at the old U.S. Embassy, where they pronounced cellulitis and bursitis and made a 4-inch incision to drain the joint. They told him he would be flying home to Fort Benning on Monday. Sizemore was crushed. He had talked the doctor into letting him return to the hangar to spend his last day with his unit. When he returned, guys were suiting up for this mission. In his place, they were sending Specialist Stebbins, the company's training room clerk. Stebbins? The hangar had buzzed with jitters. Even his friend Sergeant Lorenzo Ruiz was uneasy. "I got a bad feeling, Dale." Ruiz and Sizemore were tight. They had absolutely nothing in common, but for some reason they'd hit it off years back. Ruiz was a tough kid from El Paso, Texas, a former amateur boxer who had joined the Army after a judge had given him a choice between the military or prison. In the Ranger Regiment, Ruiz had pulled his life together and excelled. He was married and had a little girl. Sizemore was just a big suburban kid, something of a ladies' man. His buddies had nicknamed him, with his full lips and big blue eyes and broad shoulders, Adonis. But Ruiz was the real romantic, out drinking with the guys, his temper would flash 1 minute, and the next minute he'd be wiping away a tear, sniffling with his Mexican accent, "I love you guys." Ruiz was superstitious. and had struggled with premonitions of his death in Somalia. Sizemore wasn't superstitious at all, but he'd made a pact with his buddy to humor him. They would both write final letters to their families that were only to be mailed if they were killed. That afternoon, as Ruiz kitted up for the mission to the Black Sea, he had reminded Sizemore about the letter. "Shut up, Lowe," Sizemore told him. "You'll be back here in a few minutes." But now Ruiz was out there with the rest of the guys catching hell. Sizemore didn't know it, but his buddy had already been mortally wounded. Sizemore wondered where Ruiz was and how Goodale and Nelson were making out. He worried about Stebbins. Jesus, Stebby was the guy who made coffee for them. Here he was, probably the best man with a saw in the unit, and the company clerk was out there fighting his battle. Listening to the sounds on the radio had a different effect on Specialist Steve Anderson. It scared him. Anderson wanted to be a soldier so bad that he had lied about having severe asthma when he joined. But now, faced with the prospect of a pitched battle, Anderson was infected by the panic on the radio. The horror hit home when Sergeant Strucker's 3-Humvee convoy had raced in, all shot up, and the docks lifted out the broken body of Private Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter to the street. Specialist Brad Thomas emerged from one of the Humvees with red eyes. He saw Anderson and choked out, "Pilla's dead." Thomas was crying, and Anderson felt himself start to cry. He was glad to be someplace safe. He was ashamed of himself, but that's how he felt. He wasn't alone. Moments after they unloaded Pilla and Blackburn, they got orders to go back out. A second Blackhawk, Durance, had crashed and was in danger of being overrun. Over the radio, they learned that Casey Joyce, another of their buddies, was dead. Brad Thomas couldn't believe it. He had been on the beach with Joyce and Pilla when they were called for this mission. Thomas had seen his friend Pilla killed and had felt through the rest of that insane ride back to the base that he wasn't going to make it. When they arrived, he had felt an enormous sense of relief. So when Strucker approached and instructed the men to start rearming, they were going back out, Thomas was incredulous. How could they go back out into that? They'd barely escaped with their lives. The whole fucking city was trying to kill them. Strucker felt his own heart sink. His vehicles were all shot up. The rear of his Humvee was splattered with Pilla's blood and brains. Strucker's men were freaking out. Mace, a grim, blonde Delta warrior, pulled Strucker aside. "Look, Sergeant, you need to clean your vehicle up. If you don't, your guys are going to get more messed up." Strucker asked his 50 gunner, "Will you help me clean up? You don't have to." Together, they set off for buckets of water, and working with sponges, they soaked up the blood and brain and scraped it from the interior. Sizemore saw all this, and it made him wild with anger. "I'm going out there with you guys," he said. He ran into the hangar, pulled on his pants and shirt, and grabbed any stray gear he could find, came running back out to the convoy with his boots unlaced and his shirt unbuttoned, and just climbed into Sergeant Raleigh Cash's Humvee. "You can't go out there with that cast on your elbow," said Cash. Sizemore ran back into the hangar and found a pair of scissors. He cut straight up the inside seam of the cast and then flung it away. Then he came back and resumed his place on the vehicle. Anderson admired Sizemore's eagerness. He didn't know whether to feel more ashamed of his fear or a sheep-like acceptance of the orders to climb in the vehicles. Not everyone was as passive. Brad Thomas pulled Strucker aside. "Man, you know I really don't want to go back out." "Listen," Strucker said, "I understand how you feel. I'm married, too. Don't think of yourself as a coward. I know you're scared. I'm scared shitless. I've never been in a situation like this either. But we've got to go. It's our job. The difference between being a coward and a hero is not whether you're scared. It's what you do while you're scared." Thomas didn't seem to like the answer. He walked away. As they were about to pull out, though, Strucker noticed that he'd climbed on board with the rest of the men. Listening to the sounds on the radio had a different effect on Specialist Steve Anderson. It scared him. Anderson wanted to be a soldier so bad that he had lied about having severe asthma when he joined. But now, faced with the prospect of a pitched battle, Anderson was infected by the panic on the radio. The horror hit home when Sergeant Strucker's 3-Humvee convoy had raced in, all shot up, and the docks lifted out the broken body of Private Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter to the street. Specialist Brad Thomas emerged from one of the Humvees with red eyes. He saw Anderson and choked out, "Pilla's dead." Thomas was crying, and Anderson felt himself start to cry. He was glad to be someplace safe. He was ashamed of himself, but that's how he felt. He wasn't alone. Moments after they unloaded Pilla and Blackburn, they got orders to go back out. A second Blackhawk, Durance, had crashed and was in danger of being overrun. Over the radio, they learned that Casey Joyce, another of their buddies, was dead. Brad Thomas couldn't believe it. He had been on the beach with Joyce and Pilla when they were called for this mission. Thomas had seen his friend Pilla killed and had felt through the rest of that insane ride back to the base that he wasn't going to make it. When they arrived, he had felt an enormous sense of relief. So when Strucker approached and instructed the men to start rearming, they were going back out, Thomas was incredulous. How could they go back out into that? They'd barely escaped with their lives. The whole fucking city was trying to kill them. Strucker felt his own heart sink. His vehicles were all shot up. The rear of his Humvee was splattered with Pilla's blood and brains. Strucker's men were freaking out. Mace, a grim, blonde Delta warrior, pulled Strucker aside. "Look, Sergeant, you need to clean your vehicle up. If you don't, your guys are going to get more messed up." Strucker asked his 50 gunner, "Will you help me clean up? You don't have to." Together, they set off for buckets of water, and working with sponges, they soaked up the blood and brain and scraped it from the interior. Sizemore saw all this, and it made him wild with anger. "I'm going out there with you guys," he said. He ran into the hangar, pulled on his pants and shirt, and grabbed any stray gear he could find, came running back out to the convoy with his boots unlaced and his shirt unbuttoned, and just climbed into Sergeant Raleigh Cash's Humvee. "You can't go out there with that cast on your elbow," said Cash. Sizemore ran back into the hangar and found a pair of scissors. He cut straight up the inside seam of the cast and then flung it away. Then he came back and resumed his place on the vehicle. Anderson admired Sizemore's eagerness. He didn't know whether to feel more ashamed of his fear or his sheep-like acceptance of the orders to climb in the vehicles. Not everyone was as passive. Brad Thomas pulled Strucker aside. "Man, you know I really don't want to go back out." "Listen," Strucker said, "I understand how you feel. I'm married, too. Don't think of yourself as a coward. I know you're scared. I'm scared shitless. I've never been in a situation like this either. But we've got to go. It's our job. The difference between being a coward and a hero is not whether you're scared. It's what you do while you're scared." Thomas didn't seem to like the answer. He walked away. As they were about to pull out, though, Strucker noticed that he'd climbed on board with the rest of the men. Strucker was then instructed to lead the convoy out. As he steered out the east gate, he waited for guidance from the command Blackhawk above. "You need to turn left and then move to the first intersection and take another left." Strucker made the left turn on Tanzania Street, but as he approached the intersection, gunfire erupted all around. The shots were answered by a roaring fusillade of Ranger guns. But the lead vehicles were taking the brunt of it. An RPG skipped across the top of Strucker's Humvee with a screech of metal on metal and exploded across the street against the concrete wall. The concussion lifted the wide-body vehicle up on two wheels. It occurred to Strucker that Sammy was unschooled in the art of ambush. The idea was to let the lead vehicle pass and suck in the whole column, then open fire. The unarmored flatbed trucks in the middle, loaded with cooks and clerks and other volunteers, would have made fat, vulnerable targets. By opening up on the lead vehicles, it gave the convoy a chance to back out before things got worse. Strucker shouted for his driver to throw the Humvee in reverse and told his eyes in the sky, "You need to find a different route. Go back where you came from and turn right instead of left. You can get there that way." Strucker got the whole column back up to the gate, and this time turned right. Looming ahead was a roadblock, a big one. Struka radioed, "You'll have to find us another route."
"There ain't another route."
"Well, you need to find one. Figure out a way to get there."
"The only other route is to go all the way around the city and come in through the backside."
"Fine, we'll take it." Struka knew every minute mattered. Durant and his crew wouldn't last long. When they all got pointed at last in the right direction, the convoy sped out along a road that skirted the city to the southwest, driving through an occasional hail of AK-47 fire. From the peak of one rise, they could see Durant's crash site. It was down in a little valley, but there seemed no easy way to get there. At Chalk II's original position by the target building, the war had slowed down for Sergeant Ed Urich. Urich had been left in charge of the remnants of his chalk when Lieutenant DiTommaso and eight other Rangers had sprinted down to help out the first crash site. Things grew so quiet on Urich's corner, he got spooked. He used his personal radio to call DiTommaso.
"What's up, Lieutenant?" "You need to find your way to me."
"Roger, sir. Where are you?"
"Take that big alley 3 blocks east, then turn left. Go about 200 meters. You can't miss us."
Urich had no doubt. Sammy would be waiting.
"Come on, guys. We gotta go,"
he reluctantly informed the men. They began moving east down the alley. They stayed a few steps off the stone walls on that side of the street. The natural inclination was to get as close to the wall as possible. The wall suggested at least a margin of safety. But Sergeant Paul Howe, one of the D-boys, had advised them against it. "Bullets follow walls," he explained. "The walls act as funnels. Some rounds would actually ride the walls for hundreds of feet." At the intersections, they would stop and cover each other. They leapfrogged across. It didn't take long for the shooting gallery to open up. Urich couldn't believe it when they'd made it the entire 3 blocks without any of his men being hit. At the intersection of the main road, he looked downhill and saw Waddell against the wall on his side of the street. Across the street at the opposite corner, behind a big tree and car, were Nelson and Sergeant Alan Barton, who'd roped in from the combat search and rescue bird. Specialist Lance Twombly moved down that side of the street and crossed the road to add his saw to Nelson's M60. Nelson had his M60 machine gun propped on the roof of a little Fiat with belts of ammo draped over the side. From the two dead Somalis in the street alongside the car, blood formed red-brown pools in the sand.
"Can't get much worse than this," Barton said.
Just then, an RPG exploded against the opposite wall with a brilliant flash and a chest-wrenching blast. This made them laugh. It was raining RPGs. They would drop down from the north and hit the side of the stone buildings and splash along the walls, great streaking explosions, like someone throwing fireballs.
"God damn, this is unreal," Nelson said to Twombly.
Nelson was fiddling with his M60 when a Somali ducked out from behind a tin shed about 10 feet up the street and fired at him and Twombly. Nelson knew he was dead. Rounds hit between his legs and he felt them passing next to his face. Twombly dropped the man. He fired his saw about 2 feet in front of Nelson's face, so close that Nelson's cheek and nose had been singed by the muzzle heat. The blast had hammered his eardrums, blinded him, and his head rang.
"That hurt," Nelson complained. "I can't hear and I can't see. Don't you ever fucking shoot your weapon off that close to me again."
Just then, another Somali took a shot at them, and Twombly returned fire with his rifle directly over Nelson's head. After that, Nelson wouldn't hear a thing for many hours. Sergeant Paul Howe and the three men of his Delta team had still been back on the target house roof when they saw the combat search and rescue team roping down from a Black Hawk about a quarter mile northeast. Howe didn't know why the team was roping in. He got the full story about the crash when he was summoned downstairs by the Delta ground commander, Captain Scott Miller. "We're going to move over there and secure it." Miller explained that the ground convoy, which was loading the Somali prisoners out front, would drive over to the crash site. The rest of them were going to move there on foot. Captain Steele saw the operators come spilling out of the courtyard, moving east toward him. Steele and Miller conferred briefly about how to proceed and agreed that the Rangers should take front and rear positions. This column of about 80 men would set off on foot just minutes after Lieutenant Colonel McKnight's ill-fated convoy departed the target building. While that convoy wandered hopelessly lost through the city, getting hammered, and while Durant's Black Hawk was crashing about a mile southwest, this force of D-boys and Rangers were having their own tragic difficulties moving on foot to the first crash site. Captain Steele, who had a radio strapped to his broad back, fell further and further behind Lieutenant Perino and the rest of Chalk One. The idea was to stay spread out and provide covering fire for each other as they went through intersections, but right away, to Steele's dismay, the formation broke down. The D-boys ignored the marching orders and just kept moving forward. These were men trained to think for themselves and act independently in battle, and now they were doing it. Steele's Rangers were younger, less experienced, and terrified. Some tended just to follow the D-boys instead of staying with their teams. Steele saw a complete breakdown of unit integrity before they'd moved two blocks. In short order, Howe and his Delta team were in front of the force. Howe was way past worrying about staying in formation. The street was a kill zone. Survival meant moving like your hair was on fire. It was time to lead by example. The goal was to punch through to the downed helicopter, and every second mattered. The greatest danger was in getting pinned down. The Rangers followed as well as they could, leapfrogging across the intersections. Specialist Stebbins, the company clerk along for his first real mission, and 60-gunner Private Brian Hurd kept up with them, reassured just to be close to the D-boys. Stebbins trotted, crouched and careful, staying away from the walls as the D-boys had advised. As Stebbins came upon one door, a Smalley came running out of the building into the courtyard, and Stebbins fired. It was instinctive. The man startled him. Bang, bang, two rounds. The man dropped to a sitting position, clutching his chest and looking amazed. Then he slumped over forward and began to rock and moan. Most of the Sammies were dusty and wore shabby clothes, but this man was dressed nicely, and he was clean. He seemed completely out of place. Stebbins had just shot him. He'd never shot anyone before. Stebbins was readying to shoot the man again when his weapon was grabbed by Private Carlos Rodriguez. "Don't waste your rounds on him, Stebby. Just keep moving." Sergeant Goodale, who had once bragged to his mother how eager he was for combat, felt terrified. He was waiting for his turn to sprint across the street when one of the D-boys tapped him on the shoulder. Goodale recognized him. It was the short, stocky one, Earl. Sergeant First Class Earl Fillmore, a good guy. Fillmore must have seen how scared Goodale looked. Fillmore winked at him. "It's all right. We're coming out of this thing, man." It calmed Goodale. He believed Fillmore. By the time they were three blocks over, Howe's team was way out front. With them were Stebbins, Hurd, Goodale, Perino, Corporal Jamie Smith, and a few other Rangers. Over the crest of the hill to the north, Howe saw a signal smoke from what must have been the crash site. They were about 200 yards away. There was a blizzard of fire at the intersection, automatic rifle fire and RPGs from all directions. Howe felt the force was in peril of getting stuck and cut to ribbons. He shouted back down the street to Captain Miller, "Follow me!" and plunged straight down the left side. Stebbins and several other Rangers followed. Moving up in front of Perino, Goodale saw the familiar desert uniforms down the street and inwardly rejoiced. They made it! Once they linked up, the convoy would arrive and they could all roll out of this hell. The sun was getting low in the sky. Goodale had promised his fiancée, Kira, that he'd call tonight. He had to get back in time to make that call. Goodale turned to pop off a few suppressive rounds when he felt a shooting pain. His right leg seized up, and he fell over backward right into Perino. A bullet had entered his right thigh and passed through him, leaving a big exit wound on his right buttock. Perino left Goodale with Sergeant Bart Bullock, the same Delta medic who had earlier in the fight helped patch up Ranger Todd Blackburn after his fall from the Black Hawk. Goodale lay back on the dirt as Bullock looked him over. "You got tagged," Bullock said. "You're all right, though. No problem." Goodale was disgusted. Game over. He took off his helmet then saw an RPG fly past no more than 6 feet in front of him and explode with a stupendous wallop about 20 feet away. He put his helmet back on. This game was most definitely not over. Bullock dragged Goodale into a small courtyard, and the Delta team headed by Sergeant Norm Hooten hopped in with them.